both wear flippers. I assure you, and of course, not only do we have our observers, but there were 44 people, you know, as part of our team, and I need to honor my team. They were worked their asses off, to be crude about it, for the last 4 years to make this happen, as I did. And none of us would sully our reputation and our name on this record by doing anything untoward, anything that would be adverse to the basic rules of never having any kind of aid for flotation and never having any kind of unnatural aid for forward movement. I swam. We made it, our team, from the rocks of Cuba to the beach of Florida in as squeaky clean ethical fashion. And I'm here today, you know, to perhaps take you through the, if you want it, the evolution of jellyfish gear that we developed. I'm very proud of those innovations because this isn't just, oh, you know, it so hurts so much to get this thing. All of us know what pain is. All of us. Everybody on this call, you, those of you from the sport, you know, on this call, know what pain is, and you've all been superheroes in resisting pain and withstanding it, myself included. But this animal is different. This is a potentially fatal thing. More people since 1950 have died from box jellyfish than have shark bites. And after I went through it and my crew watched me with no hyperbole whatsoever almost die in 2011, they begged me to switch to the Maldives, to Guam, to Thailand, somewhere else, and I considered it. But this swim is the one that was in my imagination and my heart. So instead of switching, I went to scientist Dr. Angel Yanagihara, who's on the call, by the way, who's the world's leading expert in this particular jellyfish, went to, you know, extraordinary measures, because I found out that even with a millimeter of skin showing, pantyhose over the face, if the lips are open just to breathe, you still are stung and you go into paralysis, and I'm lucky that I lived. So this time I went with full protection, and I had also, you know, done, you know, through this evolution, everything we thought we needed to do for this particular body of water to be safe and not to die. And any other swimmer would make it across. And please believe me if any misquotes came from me about Benny Palfrey or Chloe McArdle. I never meant any disrespect. I can tell you that I have tremendous respect for both of them. They are awesome champions and swimmers. It's just that, I'll be honest, I wanted to be the first to make it across, and I'm sure they did too. But anybody who comes after me who wants to use these technologies we've developed, I am open to share them, to give them, and to accept any other swimmer who makes the cross with these particular technologies, as long as I said this morning, the basic tenets of never receiving any sort of flotation help, never receiving any sort of forward motion help. I made it across out in the open ocean, unaided. And that's my opening statement, and I thank you. I want to be dignified and respectful. You all deserve to ask your questions. Frankly, if somebody else did this swim, after all of us knew how difficult it is and how nearly impossible it is, I would want to know. I would ask questions myself about the navigation and how they did it, and I would want to be clear before celebrating that they did it in the utmost of ethical fashion. So that's my opening statement. Let me turn it back over to Steve now, and he will conduct the interview. Thank you again, all of you, for your time and your high regard.
Thank you, Diana. Now, we're going to address initially two primary questions, and then each of you will have opportunity to ask any question from Diana or her team, and then we'll get into any other questions that you may have. So I want to address the question. Just a very basic question is, did Diana Nyan swim across the Straits of Florida from shore to shore, from Havana, Cuba to Florida? And I think to put it in perspective, Forrest Nelson and I had a talk with John Bartlett a few days ago, and it was very educational. And John, I don't mean to put you on the line, but can you recap the conversation that you had with Forrest and I in order to put the parameters of her swim together? How did you plan for the swim, and how did she get across? And then what we'll do is we'll open that up for questions, beginning with Forrest, and then David, etc. So, John, if I can ask you just to take us through the question, who did you plan and how did she get across?
Okay, sure. I've been studying this, the Gulf Stream currents out there for about 3 years right now, and more generally, I had been sailing in the areas, in this area, with that Gulf Stream crossing and the one to the east between the Bahamas and Miami, and had done that many, many times, but it's very different trying to travel through those strong currents at a slow speed, and I found that and got an education initially when I dove into this process, but with readouts from oceanographers through time, going back about 3 years ago, I would have prints as to what the estimated configuration of the currents would be, and then I would on a plot sheet that I created, I would plot a swimmer's path or Diana's path at an average of a mile and a half per hour through those currents, kind of changing the angles that we steered the boat to compensate for the current, so we didn't just entirely get swept away, and for the purpose of trying to make some northerly gain to get to Florida. And through time, I've learned that probably about half the time that Gulf Stream entirely prohibits a swimmer from swimming across to Florida. I would put the percentage at about 50% of the time. Other times, there are currents that are fairly favorable, and sometime in particular, just back in the middle of this past month, I saw one that actually, a current configuration from our oceanographer, it actually blew me away. It was something that I never thought I'd even see, and it allowed a swimmer to get all the way to Key West at a mile and a half an hour in 37 and a half hours. And I think with that configuration and with the reasonable weather, or the weather that we had on our swim now, but with that Gulf Stream configuration, we might have done this not in 53 hours, but in 37 and a half hours. But that's just a tremendous rarity. And to kind of generalize, there's an intersection out there that's a little more than halfway between Cuba and Florida, where latitude 24 intersects longitude 82. And I have found, from my experience plotting, that out in that area, oftentimes the Gulf Stream will be running the axis of the Gulf Stream, which is what the strongest part of the Gulf Stream is referred to as, and it can be running at 3.5 to 4 nautical miles an hour. Out at that intersection, oftentimes the Gulf Stream runs what I describe as flat. It runs flat across there, just basically due east. And in that configuration, when the Gulf Stream is running strong, they're virtually, and I've plotted this 100 different times, virtually there isn't a way to get a swimmer at a mile and a half or 2 miles an hour for that point across those strong currents and vector and tweak and work your angles and make it to Florida. It's just not even possible. However, a lot of the time out in that area, the current has a little bit more of a northerly flow, and there's a pretty good average period of time in the better half of those currents where there's a pretty good northerly flow, east due east being 90, and sometimes the flow will be flowing in the direction of 80. If you can visualize a compass rose, could be flowing at 80 or maybe 75 degrees, which gives a swimmer a tremendous advantage. What we had in this case was out to the west of Key West, there's what some of the oceanographers call a gyre, or another term for it is an eddy, but it's a counterclockwise eddy rotating out there, kind of subtly and a little bit amorphous, but affecting the actual flow of the current. And there was a sweep from the bottom of that eddy down out in this general area that I'm describing, that intersection between 24 and 82. The bottom of the eddy kind of swept down through that area, and then the eastern side of it, as the turn, its clockwise rotation, it flowed back up toward the north and around up into the Gulf of Mexico and then kind of completed its circle. So it was creating a pretty good tweak or bend to the flow of the axis out in that area, which I knew was going to be really good for us. And in plotting it, it looked to me like it was going to be between a 55 or a 60-hour swim, and I wouldn't have guaranteed that we could have made it to Key West with that configuration. A couple things were a little better out there than I had anticipated, but I was anticipating more likely coming into Bayahan State Park, which is a little bit further up the Keys, we just had the opportunity when the weather lined up for us that was our configuration. I'd been watching it and it had been changing subtly, but pretty much that eddy was kind of holding in position for about 2 weeks for us when we got our weather window, and that's what we did. And with that combination, with that, I have learned that ultimately what we needed, and I think what anybody will need when they make this kind of attempt again, and there'll be bunches of others, I'm sure, would be to actually have accurate verification readings of those currents out there. And that's what we did the day before. It was actually a day and a half before. We went over on a Thursday and we swam on a Saturday morning. Well, when we went over on Thursday, if you just left a straight line from Key West to the Marina Hemingway, which is actually about 12 miles west of Havana, just a straight line, we stayed right on that straight line. And about every 10 miles, we stop the boat in the water, and we have a technique for taking really precise and accurate readings of the current flow as we went across. And we did that about every 10 miles. And that just kind of confirmed what the oceanographer had been predicting. And it was elating to me to see that we had that confirmation as we went across. And I reported back immediately on the sat phone that we had a good stream. And last year we had different intelligence. We had different oceanographers working for us, and we had what I thought was a Gulf Stream configuration. And when we went across, this was the second attempt last year, when we went across and I took these readings, I was shocked by how different the readings were from what I had been given on paper. And when we got over to Havana, we had a leaders group meeting, and I just explained to everybody that we've got a Gulf Stream out there that we're not going to get across. And everybody, we all just looked at each other, and everybody was there, the whole team, all the escort boat, and all the support vessels. And we just, it came down to, well, what are we going to do? We're here. Let's just give it a shot. And we went out there and gave it a shot. And the weather kind of took us out in combination with the jellyfish, really before the Gulf Stream ended up finishing us off. But the whole thing was really a debacle of bad circumstance. And to kind of wrap up my point, out there at latitude 24, that critical juncture at latitude 24 and 82 longitude, where we really need, a swim really needs a flow that's going northeast, or at least has some northerly quality to it. That year, we had 0.8 knots of current flowing at about 110, 20 degrees south of east, right at that juncture, and it was bad all the way across. But that was the key component, was that central area where it was the strongest. So we had a really good combination of we didn't have ideal weather. Diana worked with the weather. It was a little bit windier than we had hoped. But we did have a good Gulf Stream, and I think the good Gulf Stream is what really allowed us to make this thing happen. And Forrest and I talked about that, and I kind of described a little bit how we work the angle of the boat against those currents, and we end up with a crabbing action, or it's a side slip in the right direction, for instance. Sometimes we'll be heading, the boat will be heading almost due west, but we'll be going very much northeast, or even closer to north, actually traveling sideways, unbeknownst to anyone out there, because we don't know that unless we look at our instruments. And that's my job, is to control that, to keep us going in the right direction, even though how we have to steer the boat is out to the west to you know, deflect off that and benefit from that current flow. And I think that's pretty much what Forrest and I talked about. He may have asked me some more specific questions that I don't recollect right now, but that was pretty long-winded. I'm sorry if that was the case, but that's kind of the perspective on the Gulf Stream.
Thank you very much, John. Now, what we'll do is we'll go from the swimmers on the line. We'll just go one by one. I'll call your name. If you have questions, either a question or questions, feel free to address them right now specifically to John and the navigation, and then we'll get to your other questions later. Forrest, do you have any questions for John?
Yeah, John, I'm going to ask the question again that we approached last week, and that was the data that I have seen other individuals attempt, that they see deep or in the second day of swimming, I believe it's the 27th hour, where Diana's speed dramatically changes, and that her speed becomes much faster, and it's extended over many hours. I'm not exactly sure how many, but I believe it's more than 6 hours. Of sustained speeds faster than we know Diana can swim, and frankly, what most swimmers are capable of swimming. Can you describe the conditions that allowed her, that would explain why she was swimming so quickly?
Yeah, sure. There are two things that are going on out there. There's the speed that Diana swims through the water, which is a constant speed. It varies slightly depending on whether you know, how tired she is, maybe, or if she's colder, or if she's burdened by having to wear that silicone mask and that type of thing. But her range of swimming is nearly like clockwork, and I do all my navigating based on that speed that I know she swims. If she's at 51 strokes, I know how fast she goes. If she, in her worst moments, slows down to about 47 strokes, I know how fast she's going, and I stay in contact with the. Sometimes I'll do my own counts, and sometimes I'll stay in contact with the handlers. So our speed to the water is darn nearly a constant. What's not a constant is the variety of currents. They start easy and they pick up, and then out in the access area, that central area that I was alluding to, they're very strong. And as we get out in those currents, what you're seeing is a combination of the speed of us being, you know, of Diana propelling herself through the water, and the speed that the current, with which the current is carrying us across the bottom. It's always going to be a combination of those two things. And I can give you an example here where we were traveling the fastest. By the way, I went over, well, that'll probably be a different question, but I did go over a whole bunch of stuff today. Let's see, we've got segment speed 158. Here's a segment speed 144. Okay, here we go. At noon on our second day, at noon on our second day, for instance,
John, the start time for Diana's swim is 9 a.m.?
Yes, 9 a.m., yeah.
Okay, so for the swimmers' purposes, a lot of marathon swimmers would call that 0 hour. And so if we're talking noon at day two, for the swimmers, that's hour 27.
Okay, so you're talking 24-hour time then?
Many of the observers' logs are based on...
Well, that would be something different again. That's not 24-hour time. That's something different. That would be how you guys refer to it. I don't have that. I haven't done my notes that way, but you can.
We'll do the calculations. But you're talking. But the start time was 9 a.m. and you're talking day two now at noon.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
And at that point, let me look at my chart here. Noon for the noon plot, just to see relatively where we are. We're beginning to enter into a 3.3 knot current, and that 3.3 knot current is flowing at 75 degrees. If you visualize a compass rose, it's not 90, but it's got a nice It's got a nice bit of that northerly flow to it. We're entering right into that, and at that point, we're going 3.5 miles an hour over the bottom. Now, Diana would be, of course, still swimming at her 1.5 typically right there. And let me look at another plotting I have here. And for instance, we would have been steering the boat. We did steer the boat at we were steering at right about 290. So we're steering just above westerly at 290, and we're making good over the bottom about 40 degrees. So we're steering way off to the west, and we're actually traveling 40 degrees about northeast at that speed at that moment. And we did that for quite a while. What we're doing is by just trial and error, I can determine, and this was all done on paper. I actually had all this plotted in the marina before we even left. I didn't have to do any of this. I knew what our compass headings were going to be at each interval along the way in those currents. I had all that work was all done in advance. All I did was make minor adjustments with the compass calls to the helms people. But that'd be an example for us. And that that 3.5 mile an hour speed went on for quite a while. Okay, here's our fastest. I've got a 397 miles per hour, and that's the fastest that I believe we went out there. I think I saw my GPS bumping up or bouncing up to right around 4 miles an hour. But this 397 miles per hour is, over a 5.5 hour period. Our average speed over the bottom was 397. So during that 5.5 hour period, very likely our speed was actually bumping up over 4, probably bouncing between 3.8 and 4.1, something of that nature. But that average is between noon and 5:30 of the second day. 5:30 p.m. That's when that was occurring. That's over a distance of about 19 miles between noon and 5:30 on the second day, September 1st. We started on the 31st, and this would be the second day. So we would have been out there one night, and then this would be going into the just approaching evening on the second day. And at that point, we are let's see, 5:30. At that point, we're we've crossed. Actually, at that point, we've crossed the strongest parts of the current. However, the angle of the current has been progressively changing in our favor as we've progressed. Like for instance, the first entering into that period, we had a 3.3 knot current at 75 degrees, and at the end of that fast period that I just described, the current had slowed down to 2.4 knots. However, the direction of the current was much further north. It had moved from 75 degrees up to 50 degrees at the tail end of that. So as the angle changed, the speed diminished of the current, the angle changed in our favor. So that allowed us to continue that fast speed through that time period and over that 19 mile distance. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you, John. Steve, that's all for me.
Okay. I just wanted to, if people are taking notes, Diana actually started at 9:02. And next is Evan, if you have any questions. John?
For John specifically?
Yeah.
About the ocean? Okay.
Yeah. We'll get to other issues later.
I'm sorry, did I miss something there? Was that Evan?
I guess I'm interested in to what extent you were able to actually measure the current. currents on the boat, and how many measurements did you take over the course of the swim, and were these recorded down in your observations as a navigator?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm glad you brought that up. When I went over on Thursday, we were actually able to take a very, very precise measurements with the technique that we have by bringing the boat to an absolute standstill in the water. We have a little gizmo that we hang in the water so that we can determine that the water is not moving, that the boat is not moving through the water. And with that, when we bring it to a complete standstill, just looking at this gizmo that we have hanging in the water, we call, you know, when the boat is not moving, we'll take the marks off the GPS immediately, and that'll give us the speed that the current is traveling, and it'll also give us the direction that the current is traveling. However, going back, while we're swimming, I record to the best of my ability with less precision. Most of the times when we'd stop and Diana would do a feeding, I would write down what I thought the current was doing, and I'd be getting that movement. I'd be getting those same readings from my GPS. However, we never really could get the boat to a real complete standstill while Diana was feeding. The helms person would be working the throttle just a little bit to kind of hold the boat in a steady position for her, so she didn't have to, you know, if the boat was moving in the wind, and we always had a little bit of wind, we had 7 or 8 knots of wind at least almost the whole way. So the boat would be moving in the wind a little bit, and they would do the best with their motive being to keep the boat in a position where she didn't have to swim to keep up with the boat while she was trying to be fed. And I would take readings then, which relatively coincided with the ones I took coming across. However, they were with much less precision. So I do have a lot of those currents recorded on the way back as well. And I found generally, Evan, that it hadn't changed much. Fortunately for us, it hadn't changed much in those couple days. And with my experience looking at it daily, I have found that things typically in the current patterns don't change that quickly. Over a 3 or 5 day or maybe a 7 day period, sometimes they'll move around and there'll be different configurations will pop up, but. But over the course of a couple, 2-3 days, they don't usually change that much, which was fortunate for us. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I appreciate the answer, and I think it will be very interesting to take your observations from the boat and plot it on top of or alongside some of the observations of the currents that are publicly available, and also that Dr. Roffer was talking about on the news that I watched. So I think that'll all be helpful for future swimmers to look at.
Yeah,
thanks a lot.
With our oceanographer, our primary guy, there were a couple other websites I looked at also, but with our primary guy, he had a very nuanced, detailed printout that he referred to as altimetry. So they had some different techniques for determining the flow. And I found consistently we went out a few times and took observations from Key West and crossing over the swim, that the prints I got for him were very accurate, and they had different length arrows indicating the flows, and you could scale off the length of those arrows on a scale that was provided on those prints. However, he admitted that the speeds were not to be relied upon on his prints, more only the directions. So it was that just made it more invaluable. And when he told me that, he said they could be off by as much as 50%. So I didn't regard the speeds that he produced for us, but just the directions. That was pretty much what I focused on. And then for the speeds, I just filled in my own observations, which of course were real time observations and observations I could trust.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Number 3, David Barra. Do you have any
questions? Hi. You mentioned this Eddie. Well, maybe it was Mitch Roffer that mentioned these eddies occur approximately once a month. So, I'm curious as to if you could put a percentage or apply a percentage to this question. How much weight does the appearance of this eddy have relative to weather conditions decide when go time is?
Well, I'd like to make a couple comments on that. I don't know. There's a lot of discussion among people who just want to analyze things in, you know, in incredible depth that that ties in the eddies and the movement of the water, because there's different temperatures in the water as it moves. There's upwelling. They want to tie that into the weather patterns. But that's something that was, I thought, the effects of which, that knowledge, the effects of that knowledge to us would be subtle and not necessarily relevant. I don't know how much accuracy there is in that. Our weather observations and choosing what we called our weather window was really a separate process, and it was done by meteorologists. That didn't deal with currents. The currents were like a whole separate department. And regarding the reference to the gyre, I think I read of, is this the guy that's up in Melbourne?
Yes.
Melbourne, Florida?
Yes.
Yeah. I think I read that reference, and I wouldn't necessarily agree with that information that these only appear once a month, because in the last couple months, I've seen a number of small ones appear out west of Key West, kind of move along. You know, they stay small and fairly contained, and they sweep through the Keys and up past the Keys. And when I first came on board with land, there was a huge one that got down right in the middle of the Gulf Stream between Key West and Savannah, and that would have been a real problem to get through. Then, in addition to that, the one that I had been watching that we benefited from had been sitting out there about 2 weeks, with different relative dominance as it kind of sit there, but it maintained its rotation. So I don't know if I would go necessarily with that visualization that this is something that just pops up like once a month. I don't know if I would concur with that.
Go ahead. Do you have any more questions?
That's it for me.
Next, a person is Michelle Macy. Do you have any questions? Michelle?
Oh, am I off mute now?
Yes.
I don't have any questions for the skipper. Thanks.
Okay. Barbara Held?
I have a question that's not exactly the skipper question, but it's based on something he said, and it may lead to a question directly to him, which is, how was being handled this time? Was it off the side of the boat on a rope, or was it off of the boom that the streamer was attached to, like in the previous attempt?
Why don't we just, Barbara, we'll keep that question, because I just want to move through this, and I want to stay on point.
But it's something he said, depending on the answer.
Okay.
If the question's permitted, then I'm sorry, you'll have to repeat the first part of the question. I didn't hear all those words.
I'm curious how the speeding was handled. Was it off the side of the boat, off the rope, or was it like in the previous attempt off the boom that the streamer was attached to?
No, Barbara, this is Diana, and Bonnie, my head handler, is here with me. I'll take this over because this is not John's domain. If you see the pictures of this boat called the Voyager, it's a catamaran, and off the back end of it, it's got a low transom, almost down at the surface level. It has a little lip on it, like you can't sit on it and hang your legs over it. It's got a little 2-foot lip on it. But Bonnie and her handler's team, you know, get themselves down there. They've got ice chests.